The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
And the next thing I know, I'm waking up, and, you know, I go outside, and I remember her saying, "You got a pitch today." I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "San Diego, you got a pitch." I said, "No, I pitch tomorrow." She says, "Oh, no, 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 look, look." And I said, "Well, what happened to yesterday?"
Hey, everyone. It's another Loose Cannons podcast coming at you. Today we're going to be discussing 2014's No No, a documentary directed by Jeffrey either Radice or Radice about Doc Ellis, pitcher extraordinaire. Before we do that, let's do this little segment we like to call Heralds and Denouncements. Boop-a-da-boo! Wow! First thing we're going to herald is Mitchell is joining us on this podcast replacing Basil today, so give a nice big wave to the audience, Mitchell.
I'm waving. Hey, y'all. Glad to be back.
We're glad to have you.
Glad to have always. You.
Aw, thank you.
That joke has levels. Because you assume that we can see Mitchell, but we actually can't see him either.
We're all wearing blindfolds, apparently.
Yep.
Just spicing up this experience for everyone.
Yeah. I actually do have some. I have something that I could herald and something that I could denounce, but I feel more like heralding something today because... I'm feeling down today, so I want to talk about some good stuff. And so I watched Jafar Panahi's latest film, Taxi.
Nice.
It's another movie that I regret not seeing last year because it definitely would have made my top 10 of last year, much like World of Tomorrow, a great 2015 film that I saw at the beginning of 2016. But
just counted
yeah.
as this year.
I mean, yeah, I guess so. I'll just go back in the podcast and just erase all the stuff that I said about, you know, whichever movie I choose to take out.
No, just talk about it on this year's podcast, on this year's...
Count it as this year?
Yeah, this was my first ability to see it, so it's a 2016
I guess so,
movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I don't know about that.
I don't know. Yeah, it probably did come to a theater, and I just missed it, I don't know, but yeah, it's a really good one, and actually a lot more fun to watch than This Is Not a Film, because when I remember This Is Not a Film was actually kind of boring watching it, because it was just him like sitting around his apartment for most of the time. But this one, it's hard to tell like who's actually a character and who's not. Like it feels like some of the people in the movie are like actors that he hired to come and like get in his taxi and ride around with him, but some people are just like very obviously just people that are on the street that like come up to the car and like try to sell him CDs or like, you know, it's just it's a weird blurring of what is real and what isn't. And it had a lot more like very obviously funny things too than This Is Not a Film. In particular, there's a young girl who's supposed to be his niece in the movie. I don't know if it's really his niece or not, but she has a really funny scene where she's trying to direct this like this boy who's obviously like living on the street, and like he takes this money that somebody drops on the ground, and she tells him to like go back and give them the money back because it makes her film unreleasable if she has that in there. And so she's like screaming at him to go give the money back. Yeah, it's a really hilarious and fun movie.
Taxi was released.
I also saw that movie. And it was good.
In March 10th, 2016, in Greece. So, boom.
In Greece.
2016.
Wow.
I don't think you could do that with World of Tomorrow because it was released first online on Vimeo in 2015. I don't think there's any way you can claim that was a 2016 movie.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be pretty hard.
All right, Mitchell.
It's my turn.
Yeah, Herald or Denouncement.
I'm going to lightly denounce the new Philippe Garrel movie, In the Shadow of Woman. I was looking forward to it. I think he's got some interesting stuff going on usually. This movie was just kind of the very definition of slight. It's barely over an hour, which sounds good in theory, but it's like playing with a pretty like well-worn formulaic story. Just about some silly love triangle. And to Garrel's benefit, it's pretty self-parodic. He understands that it's sort of a tired-out story, and he makes fun of his characters and himself to some degree, but it never really amounts to too much. And afterwards, finding out that there were, like, four writers on this movie, two of whom were pretty legit people, like an old Buñuel collaborator and a Piala collaborator, as well as Garrel and his wife, it felt like a lot of overkill for not a lot of substance. It's not horrible by any means, but it's a trifle by definition. So, denouncing In the Shadow of Woman.
Ugh, those disappointments, those are always the worst.
Yeah, I was sad about it.
When you're expecting more of the people that you go see the movie.
He's a pretty cool guy. I've been waiting for months for this one, but no such luck.
Yeah.
C'est dommage.
I guess I'm going to denounce Hail Caesar because I did watch it. And I did not like it. I feel a little weird to announce because I didn't completely hate it because I guess I actually watched it as a sneak preview and was like, oh, well, at least this movie is showing. Like, there could have been worse movies showing, I guess. Could have been.
Certainly could have.
So it was all right. I do not remember pretty much any of the movie, which just pretty much tells you how good that must have been. But I thought it was like it was okay, entertaining, and I thought that I guess the Coens have just gave up on trying to do like new stuff and just like rehashed a lot of the things. Like, that movie reminded me a lot of like parts of Barton Fink, and then like parts of like Hudsucker Proxy, and then parts of some other stuff that they've done. And like it was just weird. It was just like somebody doing like Mad Libs with their own movies. It wasn't great, but I don't know, like, if this movie ends up on my worst of the year, I would feel like that wasn't like a bad year, because like it's definitely not a movie that I felt was like offensively bad. It was a bit lazy and not as funny and good as I kind of expect from the Coens, but you know, that's it, I guess. And Channing Tatum played a supposedly Soviet spy in it, which I thought was hilarious, because once you think about Channing Tatum's face and posture, he really does look like a lot of like actors that would have been like, he would have been successful in the 30s under Stalinist Moss film movies. You know, he had the physique and he had the winning smile.
I feel the opposite, in that I really want my worst of the year to be super bad. So if they were just, you know, regular, mediocre, that would be a bad year for me. Like,
as in a year where you haven't watched enough movies for there to be like 10 really like, bad ones. Yeah,
I felt like on both sides last year, my worst and best was a step down from 2014's list. I was much happier with.
Yeah, I agree with that worst of assertion for myself as well.
Yeah. The previous year.
You can do what I do and just watch terrible movies like Gods of Egypt.
Yeah.
I thought I did watch some terrible movies, but not enough, apparently.
not as terrible as the ones I watched.
Yeah, and plus I never hate those as much as you do. I mean, I'm sure I would hate God's Not Dead 2 or whatever as much as you do, but, like, when a movie is like Gods of Egypt and it's supposed to be bad and then it ends up being just as bad as I expected it to be, I can never hate it as much as something like Gone Girl, which I went into thinking I might enjoy.
Yeah, yeah.
I can see that.
From that point of view, Hail Caesar really is a pretty big disappointment because Cohen really should be doing much better than that.
It's a very empty movie. There's not much going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've entered the Kobe period of their career. They're just jacking up.
Jacking up threes.
And airballing. It looks like the Kobe of old, but the shots aren't going in.
And also they're like expecting wherever they go, everyone to just like kiss their feet because remember how good they were once upon a time?
Yeah, they have Academy Awards now.
I'm going to herald a movie called A River called Titus from 1973, directed by a person, Ritwik Ghatak, my selection from India for the 30 for 30 month, where you watch 30 films from 30 different countries. It is... I never super get into, or at least the two Satyajit Ray movies that I've seen, I wasn't really into them, and I think this takes what's good about those movies and what's good about Bollywood movies and has them exist in the same film, where it's like really melodramatic and has like a sort of unreality to film that I kind of like, but it also has like this really stripped down beauty to its shots that Ray's films achieve as well, and it's kind of smashing these disparate elements in a way that's very impressive. I really like how rarely they use close-ups in this film, and how every time that they do, it's extremely emotional and powerful. Like, it only happens during the most intense moments of the films, and then you cut to a close-up and it really lands because of how rarely they use it. In fact, most of the shots, people are like framed against like so much like environment, like the river just like stretching off to infinity, that they seem like really, you know, part of an environment as opposed to like a human story. Like, it very much feels like about the river in some ways. But yeah, I really like this film, and I think it's really good.
Nice.
How long was that one?
Only 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Wow. Short by this month's standards.
Yeah. I've watched some of the shorter ones at first. I'm going to watch some of the longer ones when spring break hits. Anyways, today we're going to be discussing a documentary, as I mentioned, called No No. About Doc Ellis, and this was Patrick's pick, so give us not the plot, I guess, but general overview of the structure of the film.
Yeah, so it's a documentary about Doc Ellis. He was a pitcher in the major leagues, and it follows pretty much most of it is his career in the major leagues, but it does start out with his early life and, you know, how he was raised and who his parents were. He grew up in Compton, out here in Los Angeles, and basically decided he wanted to focus on baseball and became a big league pitcher. Won a World Series with the Pirates, and then kind of bounced around to a few other places. Went to a World Series with the Yankees, but never really made it big after that, and eventually I think ended his career with the Rangers. And had some troubles with substance abuse and ended up being a counselor for other substance abuse people who were in prison and who were in, like, I guess, detox programs or whatnot. But yeah, that's pretty much the arc of the movie. It just kind of follows his journey.
Mitchell?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
My take on it?
First.
So, well, it's definitely an interesting story, and Doc Ellis is a pretty fascinating subject. I just always kind of run into issues personally of, like, how to weight these sort of talking head documentaries. It looks good. They have good interviews that are relevant. It tells a good story. At the same time, I don't know if I would have appreciated this movie had I not already been familiar with the story and what it was trying to do. And then also, I don't know that we want to leap into getting into the ending, but maybe it was just the way I watched it, but it felt like the ending was almost a twist of sorts as somebody who didn't know anything about Doc Ellis ahead of time. But maybe we can discuss that more and if anybody agrees or not with me on that point. So yeah, I sort of ended up in the middle on it. It was all right. He's a notable figure and a charismatic guy. Gave some good interviews. I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah, so I think the movie that kind of advertises itself about how this is about the guy who took LSD and then pitched a no-hitter and then spends, like you said, the last half of it talking about how bad drugs are and how all of y'all should definitely avoid them, I feel is like just kind of bullshitting the audience a little bit. Like, your whole hook is you're talking about a guy who took drugs and then still was like a pretty great player. Like, that's the whole hook of this movie, basically. Like, so you basically put that in your tagline, and then it's like, whoa, but don't forget, guys, like, it's bad.
Drugs. Bad.
Plus, some stuff, like, comes way out of left field, where...
what an appropriate metaphor.
Yeah, where this, the... so Doc's wife, I think, when she talks about him abusing her in like this horrible, horrible fashion, which reminded me of that Sean Penn Madonna story, or whether or not that's true. Like when
it's
I heard
definitely
that,
true.
Yeah, like it was just so awful. Like ever since I heard that Sean Penn Madonna story, I'm like, Sean Penn is just a garbage human being. And that is just like inserted, like, oh, here you go, by the way, this thing happened. And then it goes on. I felt like it didn't give that the appropriate weight. And I felt like, honestly, I thought the filmmakers are very unclear what story they're really telling here. And Doc Ellis' story is really entertaining, as Mitchell said, but I just think that it's kind of irresponsible and kind of morally... like just bankrupt to kind of shoehorn that in there, but then like leave it on this feel good thing of Doc Ellis becoming a spokesperson for like drug addicts or whatever. Like I didn't like that at all. So I give like thumbs down to this movie, unfortunately.
Not nearly to the same extent, but they did that same thing with like the racism. They're like when you're in the minor leagues, they talked about like how awful it was in some of the cities, and then like it's not really followed up on. Like it's they say like Doc Ellis was kind of like Muhammad Ali, and that he spoke out against conditions at the time, although they don't show anything that he said, which was weird. But yeah, I don't like this movie either, hardly at all. Not just the complaints that you've brought up, but I feel like there's a lot of stuff that they do as filmmakers, I feel like, to keep your interest, like playing like really jazzy music over like boring parts, or like doing like weird photo editing tricks so people like move while the background stays still. And I'm like, you're trying to keep me interested, but what you're actually doing is distracting me and making me less interested. Like, I'd rather you not do all these weird tricks or whatever. And it seemed, you know, it's like, to use a boring food metaphor, it's like when people put like a lot of salt or garnishes on like low quality food in order to cover it up. In my case, it just really drew attention to how little substance there was in the making of the film, obviously, as we've all said, not in Doc Ellis's life, which makes it even kind of more sad that they're not able to land the movie at all. But Bring us home, Patrick.
Yeah, I was disappointed by this movie. I thought that there was going to be kind of like... I thought it was kind of going to center around the no-hitter story and kind of talk about, like... I don't know. I wanted it to talk more baseball, basically. Because once it got away from baseball, like... I didn't find any of that stuff interesting, really. Like, you know, when, like, Ron Howard is talking about him being in the movie and, like, telling the story, like...
I wrote down, how many documentaries do you think Ron Howard is in? Because it's got to be in the hundreds at this point.
I don't know. But I was like, this is a really boring story and, like, a movie, a Ron Howard movie that, like, nobody has ever heard of that he was in.
Do you think he just, like, wanders around studios and, like, oh, do you need someone to sit in on your documentary? Because I'm not doing anything right now.
He's just lingering at this after his film shoots. And he's just like, hey, anybody want Ron Howard?
But all that stuff at the end about him being a substance abuse counselor just feels, I don't know, it does run in, like, a really... contradictory way to the way the rest of the film seems to be, or the way it
they're making
it
fun of PSAs earlier in the film, and then it becomes that PSA that they're making fun of.
And I was like, why did you set it up with all the, like, you know, like the crazy, like, Jimi Hendrix sounding rock music, the druggy, like, dissolves, and it's just like, this is gonna be a crazy story. And then at the end, it's like, don't do drugs, kids. And it's like, wait a second.
It's the same way that, like, a movie that, like, features, like, a half-naked woman on the cover of its a DVD or whatever, and then, like, talks about how bad sexism is or whatever, is bullshit. Like, it's just, like, it does not earn that right to be self-righteous about, or, like, be, like, morally, like, like trying to teach people or educate people about this issue, where I feel like the interesting thing is just like, oh, well, the MLB was never really honest about the fact that all of its players were taking, like, tons of drugs all the time. And, like, how that one guy in this movie mentioned, like, Babe Ruth was probably taking tons of drugs if he was also drinking and then, like, performing at an elite level at a sport where concentration is absolutely key to everything you do. So, like, I have no idea about baseball, but I assume that that's probably, like, a pretty good point that he made. So, like, yeah.
Patrick said that he wanted to learn about baseball by watching this movie, and there's one thing that this movie, I think, accidentally gets exactly perfect, which is when they interview the trainer, and he's like, I was totally against those amphetamines. He's like, I didn't allow them in my locker room. I made it clear I didn't want to know if they were taking them. Yeah. It seems like he's taking, like, this hardline stance, but really, he doesn't actually care if they take them. He's like, doesn't happen in my locker room. It happens somewhere else.
Right outside the locker room.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what a perfect metaphor for baseball's relationship with drugs for the last 100 years. This, like, extreme, hard-line, superficial stance.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty good.
The best story in this movie is basically about how he got high on drugs and threw a no-hitter. It's like, no, drugs seem kind of awesome, actually. I wish more people took drugs because that would make baseball awesome.
I like how he admits, though, like, that's like a really crappy no-hitter. Like, at the beginning of the film when they're talking about it, and he was like, 9 men on base? And, like, that's not really that much of an accomplishment. And then later he was like, yeah, that was a shitty no-hitter as far as no-hitters go. And I was like, yeah, no, that's crazy. Correct. If you walk 9 dudes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or errors or whatever.
Wait, okay. So did people realize that he's dead?
Yeah. I mean,
I did not know that before I watched
it. Like, so. I was watching the movie and I was like, there's something weird about, like, him being in this, but also, like, the way that the movie is being made. Mm. Like, it doesn't... Yeah. And so then I looked it up, and then it was like, he's dead. And then I was like, oh, when was the movie from? And then it was, like, 2014. And I was like, have they been working on this movie for like 10 years? And then that made me super sad because it's so shoddily edited.
Yeah. No, because like I didn't know that ahead of time and didn't look it up during the movie. So when they finally reveal that, it played like a weird twist to me. And I was like, oh, he's been dead the whole time.
Yeah. It might explain some of the problems with this movie if like what happened is like someone started a documentary at some point, but then never finished it. And then like this person has like been taking footage from like different places and then, you know, shot some more of these talking heads to like try to give it a structure, and it didn't super work out. Mm-hmm. Like that would make sense why it's not totally focused.
Yeah, that definitely tracks.
I mean, it just tipped me off the fact that like obviously Doc Ellis was only involved with like these like interviews from obviously a while ago. Like, just you could tell by the film stock that it was like older stuff, like older videos that he recorded. And I was like, there's like two ways. Either he's dead or he didn't want to be involved in the making of this documentary. But like going by everything this documentary was about, like he probably would have not minded being in this documentary, like going by how like open he was about his own drug use and like how open he was about all the stuff that he said. Like, would have been weird if he was like, no, this is like, I'm not going to be involved in this.
Yeah.
Too personal.
A flattering narrative, too.
It may have been that they started with the drug angle, and then once they got to interview him, like, he was like, sure, we can talk about that, but as long as you, like, throw in all this stuff about, you know, how I'm trying to, you know, like, help people rehab from drugs now, because, you know, I'm not really with that drug culture anymore. So, I mean, it's possible that they had to like compromise somewhere.
And kind but of he died like a while ago, though, right?
Well,
2008.
2008, yeah. But I mean,
were they making this movie like, for 6 years? I doubt it.
I don't know. I mean, you know, they. I guess they maybe they started with that. Like maybe they started with interviewing him. And the movie that they really wanted to make, they made after he died. Like, they were like, all right, we got all the footage of him. Like, we'll just stuff that stuff in at the end and go ahead and, like, make our, you know, our archival documentary about all the other stuff. I also thought it was weird, though, sometimes where they would have, they would just have somebody's voice, but you could like hear the interviewer ask them questions too with some of it, and then some of it was just like the regular, like, you know, the way you do that generally is like you're like, okay, I'm gonna ask you a question and you repeat the question when you answer me. So like if I ask you what your favorite color is, you could just say my favorite color is blue, so that the audience gets the question and the answer on screen. But some of it is just like you could hear the interviewer like ask the question and then just the answer comes from the person, and so it felt disjointed like that to me, like they just didn't have enough, like they didn't get to finish what they were doing. And so that supports, you know, the idea that it was, I guess, kind of a messed up thing where they kind of had to stop in the middle. Something like that.
I bet I would be more interested in the history of this documentary than the documentary itself. Something seems off about it. There's that other scene where I believe he's reading a letter from Jackie Robinson and he's having like this super emotional reaction, and yet we're just seeing like a digital version of like the letter go by, and I'm like, who wouldn't want to see his face at this point? Like, like show the letter for a little bit, but especially at the end when he just starts crying, it's like cut to his face, and then it's just like the name Jackie Robinson like moving around with the like a weird photo effect or whatever, and I'm like, no, thank you.
it does that a couple of times too, where it instead of showing you who is being interviewed, it just has the voice playing over like some pictures or whatever, and it feels off, and stuff like that like took me out of the movie a pretty good deal.
I mean, what I kind of was expecting more of is people trying to explain how a dude could Like, even if it was a bad no-hitter, could actually pitch a no-hitter while on, like, high on LSD, because that's really hard. Like, it's hard to do much of anything when you're on LSD. Like, I think, like, lying down can be pretty tough on you for a while. Like, it's like, you know, there's a lot going on in your head.
I expected them to, like, go through the game and be like, oh, yeah, there was this one point where I thought, you know, we thought he was going to, like, you know, give up a hit or a run or something like that. But then they didn't, like, play up the drama of, like, him actually getting the no-hitter. And I guess maybe it wasn't that interesting a game because it wasn't even televised.
It probably wasn't. I mean, the guy was really good at also kind of, like, self-mythologizing and, like, being, like, probably no one would have given a crap about this one if he hadn't like built this whole like mythology around it and being like, oh, I did this on LSD. What? All right. Now that's interesting.
I mean, the only thing he says is that part about like, I could see whether the batter was on the left or the right. And then the catcher put tape on his hand so I could see where he was signaling.
That's so weird though. That's such a specific thing to be like, to be able to focus on. I guess that would work, but I don't know. I mean, I guess everyone's experience is different, but yeah.
I mean, like, how many minutes do they actually even spend on that game? They don't even really make much of an effort to try and ask questions about it or
not really.
Yeah, it's maybe like 15 minutes of the movie at best. Like, it's it gets passed over for something that's in every single plot description for this movie.
They, like, you know, I know this comes up with like documentaries and biopics a lot, but I feel like it's definitely true in this movie that they try to cover an immense amount of stuff. They're just like, hopefully one of these things hits. Like, this, they spend like, they've got Roberto Clemente's death in here. They've got the first, you know, all person of color starters lineup or whatever. Mm-hmm. They've got, you know, the drug rehab thing. They've got the spousal abuse thing. And it's just like, there's so much in this movie. And it's like, everything gets like 5 to 10 minutes at most.
Yeah.
And like, the Roberto Clemente is probably the only part that like really hits me, but that's just because like I think, just outside, being like a baseball fan, and even though I obviously wasn't alive at that time, like knowing the story, and like that he was on his way back from like aiding his countrymen, dying in this plane wreck, and like how sad it was, like, and I was like, can't we spend a little more time on this? And then it's just like immediately cuts to the story about the like 9 starters or whatever. And I was like, I don't know.
and it was, I felt like a more interesting documentary would have been just about that Pirates team, like about the makeup of that team, like the way it came together and the way, like, because all of those guys had really interesting stories. And Doc actually had like maybe one of the less interesting stories of all those players. I mean, you know, you could have just made a documentary about like how all those players came to be in that same place at the same time, and like how, you know, Pittsburgh of all places became, you know, the first all person of color roster in Major League Baseball. And that's, you know, that would have been a much more interesting documentary to me.
I mean, I think the funniest, best part about the film is when it's talking about like their fashion and like how they, you know, were unlike other baseball players, and that they would like wear the latest fashions, wear whatever they won. And there's a part where he's wearing a shirt that, if I were a black man, I would absolutely want, that says, if I remember correctly, every N-word is a star.
Yeah.
Yep.
With like a big star around it. And I was like, that shirt rules.
That's a song.
I remember that shirt.
That's that song. It's Kendrick Lamar actually sampled it on To Pimp a Butterfly.
He also kind of looks like he's wearing the Bruce Lee / Beatrix Kiddo all yellow jumpsuit at one point. And I was like, that was pretty awesome funny. Too.
That was pretty fun, and that would have been just more fun to explore. Also, like you said, you don't ever really hear anything that he said, you know, as far as like speaking out the way Muhammad Ali did. Like,
like there's a newspaper clipping that says Doc Ellis, the Muhammad Ali of baseball, and I'm like, Okay. Yeah.
I guess there's that one thing that they talk about where he was like, oh, they won't start two black pitchers in the All-Star game or something like that. But that's maybe the only thing.
I did think the story of Muhammad Ali beating the crap out of him was pretty funny, though.
Yeah. Where he was just like jabbed at him like once or twice, and then that was enough. That was pretty funny.
I mean, it's...
It just shows you how intimidating Muhammad Ali was.
But he talked about things that he had reason to talk about. Like, this guy, probably high off his gourd, being like, yeah, I can box Muhammad Ali.
I can move my feet really fast.
Like, that, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like you'd like hope a movie like this would have... learned lessons from other talking head documentaries and biopics. It's just, I think it's pretty common knowledge at this point that it's sort of a hacky genre that's hard to get right. And I think this movie confuses some things. I mean, like the spousal abuse thing, clearly they wanted to sort of insert that in there to kind of give you a fuller picture. People tend to complain when, you know, they pick and choose positive and negative elements, but I mean, there's a point where it becomes, you know, offensive to not incorporate it further, just to gloss over it the way that they do. I mean, I think it's equally important to concentrate on one thing, as we've already sort of touched on, and not just throw everything at the wall like they did. It's a little overbearing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can capture positive and negative without covering every incident. Like, I think you can capture the positive and negative of one theme. Like, if the theme is, you know, I don't know, I guess how drugs affected his life and his mythology, like, you could cover that one theme and just focus on both the positive and the negative of that.
And I think that would be perfect. That's probably what people were coming to see with this movie.
It's definitely
the part they played up the most in all the promotions.
What I was expecting from this, too, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's what I was excited for. And it's not in there very much. And then it gets preachy at the end.
Yeah.
What is in there is video of a young Nixon. Whoa.
Oh, man.
Nixon is one of those people I imagine always being old.
Yeah. His face never really changed. He's had a different haircut.
Well, this movie doesn't get at baseball very much. It does actually sort of, again, not intentionally, like, capture a lot of how baseball players feel about the game. Like, how, like, superstitious they are. Like, they don't exactly say that, but, like, there's a part where he's like, the game is won or lost in the clubhouse, and he's like, you gotta have a loose clubhouse. If you loose, then you'll win the game. And it's like, no, the game's mostly won on talent, but like, it's like, this is how like athletes feel, and especially in baseball, because baseball is a game where talent shows up like over a long period of time. And so, like, you can go through, like, extreme hot streaks or extreme cold streaks because, like, it's so random on, like, a pitch-to-pitch basis, you know, in order to, like, actually determine what someone's talent is. You have to look at not just even, like, one season, but, like, you know, if you look at, like, the statistics or whatever, when things start to, like, actually round out, it's, like, multiple seasons worth of data before you, like, actually find out, like, what quality a player is. So yeah, it's like compared to basketball or whatever, where it's really like two or three games before things start to like round out into form. You get these kind of attitudes in baseball where they like have no connection to reality, really. Pitchers win through intimidation, and it's like, well, no, these are professional hitters. Like, they've gone through every level and succeeded at this point. The whole idea of like the mental aspect of the game is something that I think is pretty overrated in general in sports commentary.
Yeah, I don't know though. I do feel like
I mean, I guess they, I would be pretty intimidated if someone was like, I'm high on LSD. But like, and I pitch wherever the fuck I want.
The part that got me was when he started hitting people. I didn't think that was kind of funny. And I was like, wow, that's something that they would not let you do today. Like, you would be...
I was wondering, actually, because I don't watch baseball, if that's actually a thing that's legal, like that's, people throwing balls at
you do it striker. Like one or two times.
If they think that you did it on purpose, you're immediately thrown out of the game.
Intent is important.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, obviously, you know, pitches get away from pitchers sometimes, but like, yeah. So, you know, like, for instance, the classic example would be, so pitcher on team A, Bean's a player, right? And then pitcher on team B comes in the next inning and the Bean's a player straight away, that pitcher's probably going to get thrown out because it seems so obvious that it's a response to what happened previously. Mm. And I think if you're hit in the head, which is where they said Reggie Jackson was thrown out immediately.
Yeah, because that's fucking dangerous.
I definitely don't let you do that anymore, yeah, for sure.
I mean, all that's, you know, it still happens. It's, you're throwing 80 plus mile per hour ball. Like, sometimes strange things happen.
Yeah.
These people are the best in the game, but they're trying to hit like a 2 foot by 1.5 foot target.
Yeah, but all that stuff where they were talking about, like, I can't remember if it's Doc that says it or if it's somebody else that says it, like, oh, players, you know, wear like the bigger helmets and they have like the shin guards and stuff like that. It's like, well, yeah, they don't want to like have their faces broken by a fastball, like, you know, and they will like not only throw people out of the game, but they will like suspend them for games if they think that they're like throwing at somebody's head like that now, like, you know, baseball definitely doesn't play around with that stuff anymore the way that they used to. Like, they don't let you, like, throw at people and, like, brush them back off the plate like that.
Mm. It's crazy whenever athletes from the past talk about games in the current getting softer because they've added more rules, which doesn't usually make that much sense on the face of it. But also, just because athletes are so much bigger and faster now, when people do get hurt, they always get hurt more in today's game than they ever did in the past, because, you know, no one was throwing 105 in the 70s, but that happens these days. Aroldis Chapman can hit 106 on the miles per hour. You get hit with 106 mile per hour fastball, you're going down. It doesn't matter where it hits you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, fewer players are maimed or killed by fastballs too, so you know.
But yeah, it's so funny to me because like there's a story that just came out on ESPN today that just like captures so much of this unintentional like old versus new stuff where Goose Gossage called Jose Bautista disgrace because he flips his bat after he hits home runs. Yeah, and he said that baseball's been ruined by nerds.
that's such a funny like headline.
Most things.
Like, yeah, like ruined all athletes nerds. Say about all other sports too, right? Like basketball has been ruined by little guys like Steph Curry that they would have, in the old days, they would have just hand checked him and like,
yeah,
they would have like
try hand checking someone when they're shooting 50% from 35.
Yeah, good
feet.
Luck. Good luck. Yeah, exactly.
That's yeah.
Or like pretend like a guy like LeBron would not like just dominate everybody back then, like with his physique and his strength, like he would just run into dudes and there would never be a foul. Like, yeah, sure, he would never play as good as he's now. Like 20 years ago, such bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it's, you know, because this the old guard still is kind of in control of these networks, those are the stories you hear, but I'm sure like people like James Harden and Steph Curry love the nerds because they're like, yeah, they let us do what we're good at and they put us in a position to win. And it's, you know,
it's
no one who's happier with nerds than James Harden when the coach was like, just take threes and get fouls, and he's like, on it,
okay.
All day long, please, thank you.
When some guy who, you know, gets like 150 walks per season, gets, you know, $2 million a year extra in his baseball contract, I'm sure he's pretty happy. He's
pretty happy
with all the nerds. Whereas the guy who, you know, strikes out 250 times a year but also hits 45 home runs and doesn't get as big a contract, he's probably not as happy with the nerds.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, it's also about, like, evening the playing field too, because that was the whole thing with the, like, money ball system in Oakland. It was like, oh, our team has no money, we can't buy big expensive players, but we figured out a way around it. So it's like a, you know, democratizing of the playing field a little bit, where it's like, oh yeah, the Yankees can buy all these expensive players, but we're gonna beat them through analytics, through, we're gonna find a way to get in there and, you know, win games, even though we can't compete with them on that level. So
we're already talking about better movies than this one.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like a real thing in baseball, but yeah, it's also a better movie than this one too.
I know.
One thing that's like glossed over in this movie that is like such an enormous occasion in the world of baseball is free agency, which, you know, was not a thing for like a long time. And the only reason they bring it up is they're like, you know, this coach, he was, you know, trained in the pre-free agency era, so he thought he could tell players what to do before they, you know, the players have a bigger say now than they did in the past, when they just sort of had to accept whatever the owners dealt them.
Yeah.
Which is also why you had so many dynasties, is because the, you know, Yankees or whatever could just trade for whoever they want and then just retain all their good players with no sort of competition from anyone else to get their services. And it's like this enormous watershed moment, especially like if you're of the opinion like I am that sports is sort of a microcosm, especially pre-free agency, of like, you know, these white owners like telling people of color players like what to do and where to go and how to act. Like free agency was like the civil rights movement of sports, and then like, you know, it didn't equal the playing field, but it gave them an enormous amount more power than they ever had previous to that.
Right.
And here it's just like a little side note about how this coach was a hard ass.
Yeah, with a Rangers coach, yeah. Yeah. Not a good enough mix, I guess, of the... Or I guess not a... It could have focused more personally on Doc and not as much on, like, bigger issues, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It just feels like it doesn't have its foot firmly in one camp or the other.
I don't even think it tries to.
Yeah.
It just tries to be everywhere at once.
I think this is very much a spaghetti on the wall film, where they're just like, let's just put everything in the mix and hope that it turns out okay.
And then, like, people, oh, you liked it for this reason. Oh, and you liked it for that reason. Well, great that we put all different reasons in here and why people might like it.
A little something for everyone.
A little something for everyone, yeah. A little drama. Thing.
Yeah, and it almost feels like, I don't know, this is like a, I don't want to say a reject, but almost like a lesser version of a lot of the 30 for 30 documentaries that I see. Like, it feels like it doesn't quite...
That sounds about right.
It doesn't quite have that polish. Like, I'm sure
if
they had gone through ESPN, they probably would have cut some stuff and probably would have trimmed it down a bit. I mean, it's only an hour and 40 minutes, but I still think they probably would have, like... You know,
a lot of those 30 for 30s are less, though, aren't they?
Yeah.
A lot of them are just an hour.
And they're super specific, usually.
Yes, which is a good thing, usually.
Yeah, they probably would have
thrown out a storyline or two in this thing. And
a few, perhaps.
Cut it down.
I really enjoy those 30 for 30s, generally, and I don't really even care about sports, but they're pretty fun to watch because they're really tight and focused, and I don't know, cover social issues as well. So yeah, those are fun.
I mean,
this doesn't quite live up to that.
Like, I haven't watched that Iverson one in a while, but I remember it just covering mostly like that one incident and what that like could that what how that influenced his career and how like sort of things were going up to there, but like it didn't cover his whole NBA career later. Right. Yeah, yeah. It didn't like go into all the stuff that happened. It just like went in on this particular thing that happened. Like, you know, like there's also other stuff that Iverson did, which is really like it's its own story, but it is its own story. That's why we're not going to cover it here. You know, like I feel like especially when with a guy like Doc Ellis, who like grew up in a time or like existed in a time where he was like we touched on a lot of like subjects that this movie attempts to cover. No way that it will ever cover any of those subjects like in any like reasonable way, and it's kind of dishonest of it to attempt to, you know, like it's just like it just wants to grab everything so that in the end people will say, oh, what a great doc, it really went in on all the issues. That sucks. I mean, like I mean, maybe, especially because considering this like won a ton of awards, apparently, right? Like, it's just like
yeah, it was a big hit, at
a super huge hit.
Yeah.
I feel like that's like rewarding a kind of filmmaking that really shouldn't be rewarded.
Yeah, it definitely reminds me of what Basil has said about documentaries in the past. That this movie seems sort of like especially guilty of, that they went into it with like this idea that a documentary just in and of its subject means it's worth making a film about, and you don't really necessarily have to have the filmmaking skill like to make a piece of art out of it.
Oh yeah.
And like I was just looking at this guy's IMDb credits. This is solely he didn't even direct any shorts before this or anything. Like all he's done is produce stuff, and I think it shows. Like I feel like this very much feels like a producer's film, and that they're just like there's all these pieces together, but they're not coalesced in any sort of meaningful way, which is like kind of like a director's job, is to like focus like all these disparate elements together into like a unified thing.
Yeah, it definitely feels like each section has like the most generic sheen they could put on it. It's like, oh, they're talking about drugs, play some rock music in the background, do some like acid dissolves, and it's like, oh, they're talking about something serious, just like hold
those
on
drug please. Effects during the scenes at the beginning are the worst. Like right off the bat I knew I was pretty sure I wasn't gonna like this movie, because like the first part is they put up that quote, which I didn't think was a particularly good quote, and then they have someone say the quote that's on the screen, and I'm like, what? And then it's like, and then it's like gets right into the drug thing, when it's like the druggy Star Spangled Banner with like these weird like hallucinogenic video, and I was like uh-oh.
I did not like the soundtrack to this either, which really should have been like a no-brainer good soundtrack, like talking about like drugs in the 70s and whatever. Like, come on. Like, you'll find some good music.
Wait, there was good music made in the 70s about drugs?
Yeah, I know. Like, if you fail at that, you really should not be making stuff. Like, it's the easiest thing to...
There's just that like, weird, unfortunate perception that anything that's like nonfiction or based on a true story is like inherently superior to fiction and gets a pass, as Ruben was suggesting. And I don't know. I guess this guy just gave himself a pass while he was making this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I feel like I should do some research on the history of how this documentary came together.
It'd be very interesting to hear.
I also sort of don't want to, but like I just can't help but feel, but from like these elements, that like what happened is that they were, you know, first that they were getting some pieces together maybe, and then Doc Ellis died, and then maybe it got shelved for a while because they didn't know what they were going to do about it, and that this guy came along who is a producer by trade, not a director, and was just like, I have all this stuff that at some point I've paid some money for. Like, I got to put it together into something, but I also don't want to pay any more money or whatever to, like, hire, like, a real director. Like, this is, you know, I don't know if any of this is true, but, like, it makes sense to me based on, you know, like,
yeah,
the chronology and the fact that this guy hasn't directed anything. Granted, it's one of his most recent films, so maybe he's trying to break into directing. But
it's possible. I mean, it definitely has that feeling of something that's not quite nailed together properly. Yeah, and the fact that they, like, play up the angle of, like, oh, and he's dead, BT dubs at the end, it's kind of like, oh, right, we needed some sort of twist at the end where it's like, no, you don't have to, like, give us a twisty ending. Like, it's a documentary. Like, you know, yeah, this is stuff that's happened, you know. And it's like I said, like, there has been exactly one instance where that has worked for me. And it's so rare that ever actually works the way people want it.
And I mean, it also would have been different if it came out in, like, 2008 or 2009, because then it, like, the idea of, like, the death feeling like a sudden thing in the documentary would sort of mimic the reality of the situation. Like, I haven't seen Life itself, but I assume they must cover Ebert's death at some point in the movie, since it was made while he died, right? Yeah. And so, like, a feeling of suddenness, like, feels, you know, reasonable in that. But this came out in 2014. Like, it's been 6 years since he died.
Yeah. It's weird.
You weren't in the making of this film taken by surprise.
By his death. I think...
Or at least they're not being honest about them being taken by surprise. Anyway, it's... Yeah.
Remember that time we were taken by surprise 6 years ago and then we were on the show for 3 years and then started working on it again?
That was... It reminds me of this other documentary I watched called Dirty Wars, where the big, like, twist at the ending was about Anwar al-Awlaki, the American who was part of al-Qaeda who got killed by a drone strike. Like, the big reveal was, like, his son was also killed. It was, like, that was a very highly publicized news story, like, 4 years ago. I doubt that people have not heard of that. Like, why are you presenting it like it's a surprise? It's like, his son was innocent and he was killed. It's like, yeah, we knew that. Like, why are you throwing it out there like it's something that nobody knew?
It's
like a cheap thing to do.
The last thing I kind of have to say about this movie is that I do kind of did kind of made me want to read that memoir that he wrote with that poet in 1970s. Like,
I love that line where he's like, he said he'd never met a poet before, and I was like, that's probably not true.
Especially considering they had to put, like, the word screwdriver instead of acid and coffee instead of Benzedrine in
that was actually like, more interesting thing where he was, like, having to censor himself in the book or whatever. That
couldn't even tie back in if this movie was willing to go in on baseball at all about idea of, like, its relationship with drugs. Yeah. And, like, that could have been, like, you know, sort of where the film, like, what it could have been about would have been, like, this guy's relationship to drugs and how it mimicked baseball's relationship to drugs and how, like, you know, it, after he was out of baseball and sort of no longer had, like, this cover or whatever, that it sort of had to all come crashing down. Like, like, there's your story.
I often find the documentaries kind of go cowardly when it comes to talking about drugs. Like, they do really, like, kowtow to, you know, whatever, like, major sport they're in. It's like, it's always kind of presented as black and white, where it's like, no, drugs are absolutely not good under any circumstance ever. Like, even the 30 for 30s that I've seen that, like, deal with drugs, it's, like, always, like, drugs are presented as, like, and then drugs happened, and it was bad, and it was terrible forever in the sport, or whatever. It's more of a gray area. Like, I don't know. The only documentary that I've ever seen that actually came down in the middle on that was one called Bigger, Stronger, Faster, which actually does address, it's like, why exactly are these drugs illegal in the sports? Like, you know, it actually, like, gets into that a little bit, and I'm like, finally, somebody is, like, digging into that, because it's always presented as black and white, and, you know, I would say, like, 90% or 99% of the sports documentaries that deal with drugs that I've seen.
You should read some Peter Singer. I don't necessarily agree with this, and there's a lot of stuff that he says that I really disagree with, but he's very pro PEDs in sports, because he says that it evens the genetic playing field, that it's unfair that people who are born genetically superior get to succeed. And he's like PEDs give the people who aren't as genetically superior a chance to even the playing field.
Seems noble.
Yes, that's the democratizing
effect.
Interesting
position to take. Like, that's a position that I had not considered. But yeah, I'm like,
that you'll feel, if you read up about Pete Singer, you'll feel that way about a lot of his positions. So what I started to say was that it's so weird, because, like, yeah, this movie is like, he comes down at the end and they're like very preachy, like we all said, but there's a lot of the parts in the interview that they still somehow choose to include that are very rationalizing about, like, his drug use or whatever. Like, there's tons of parts where, like, a person is like, yeah, he drank a whole bottle of vodka in an hour and he seemed perfectly fine to me or whatever, and it's like, you know, and, like, his second wife was like, yeah, you know, I knew he was a drug user, but he always came home at the end of the night and he was, I never had any issues with it. And I was like, this is weird, like, especially for where this film ends up going, to, like, include these parts of people just being like, yeah, it wasn't that big a deal.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah. And then he, like, you know, put a gun, he was, like, holding a gun in my mouth and, you know, like, beating me. And it's like, oh, okay, well, that went somewhere else really fast.
Yeah.
Right when you needed the you know, switch to flip. It's like, oh, now we need to make this, like, the fall. Like, the fall has to happen here.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all my notes.
Yeah.
I wrote down the part when he says, I took 15 to 17 pills, because I was like, holy crap.
That's a lot of pills.
So that was funny. He was like, I only took the ones that stood up. When he just dropped,
that was part of that same scene where he's like, yeah, he's like, yeah, sometimes I take a pill, sometimes I wouldn't, then if I didn't work, then I'd take another pill, and he's like, sometimes I drop the pills, and the ones that stood up, I take them, but then sometimes none of them would stand up, and then he's like, and then I was taking 15 to 17 pills, and I was like, whoa, that
was a lot of pills. Oh, man.
Yep.
Uppers, man.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening to our podcast, even though it's just as unstructured as this movie, although I think more successfully so.
Say so.
If you are enjoying it, you can always subscribe using your podcast listening application. Give us a 5-star rating or review, and review on iTunes or review, either or, both are good.
We like them both.
And, you know, you can always watch all of our content on loosecannons.net, as well as participate on our commentary comments board forum. Sounds good.
Yeah.
We recommend that you listen to this podcast on any drug you like.
If you're able to listen to this podcast on LSD, you deserve to have a documentary made about you.
Yes.
Especially if you listen to the 5-hour podcast on LSD.
Drugs not at all detrimental to podcast listening.
All right. We will have you listen to us next time. Bye.
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 Thanks, Mitchell.
I've been doing this podcast for 3 years, and I still don't know how to sign off.
Chair. I'm gonna go to the bathroom.